The internal culture is the inside part of your external brand. And those two should be aligned. If you get the culture right, your external brand should benefit from that. You should be attracting the people that actually resonate with the culture that you're trying to cultivate. You should have relationships with customers and regulators, you know, who know you to be what it is you're aspiring to be. I am very, very supportive of ongoing assessment of an organization's culture.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change Podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and develop organizations with a remarkably healthy culture that can positively impact all of its stakeholders. Every other Thursday, we drop hour-long conversations with world-leading researchers and experts on culture, ethics, change, and leadership. My name is Tobias Sturluson, and I'm your host and the co-founder of Art Management. On the 10th of March, 2019, 24-year-old Danielle Moore jumped on a flight headed for the United Nations Environment Assembly in Nairobi, Kenya. Unbeknownst to her, Boeing, the airplane manufacturer, had created a cultural pressure on cost and speed and had cut corners on safety on their new 737 MAX, which would come to cost her and hundreds of others their lives in a tragically avoidable crash. When Ryan Hampton's doctor prescribed him OxyContin to treat some severe knee pain, Ryan had no idea how the drug manufacturer Purdue Pharma had created an unethical sales culture that aggressively targeted doctors and downplayed the risks. His OxyContin prescription would lead Ryan into a spiral of addiction, overdoses, and even homelessness. When Susan Fowler joined the exciting and fast-growing tech startup Uber in 2015, she had no idea that the job would come with a sexist culture and unwanted sexual advances from her manager, and that she wouldn't get any support from the company when she reported the violations. A healthy culture of purpose, trust, and integrity matters, of course, because it affects an organization's ability to perform its mission and deliver on its strategy. However, what we might often forget is that it also often significantly impacts the lives of employees, customers, and the society at large. About 2 years ago, I had the real privilege of interviewing Jennifer Chatman, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, Paul J. Cortese Distinguished Professor of Management, and co-director of the Berkeley Culture Center. She is a world-renowned researcher, teacher, and consultant on leveraging organizational culture. We had a really wide-ranging conversation on what it takes to change and leverage culture and the four C's that we'll talk about, and her research also on how narcissistic leadership impacts the culture and might impact it for many years. All too often, our current culture, shareholders and boards celebrate people who are successful and brilliant, but who are also detrimental to the culture over time. In our conversation, Jennifer mentioned Elon Musk as one example, an analysis that seems even more pertinent today as we're watching the shakings at Twitter. As I'm still deep at work with my upcoming book, we wanted to bring back this super insightful and relevant conversation to all of our listeners who have yet to hear it or who just need to hear it again. And it's one of those conversations that I myself keep going back to as I try to make sense of culture and how to help organizations move forward in changing and renovating their culture. So without further ado, let's jump into my December 2020 conversation with the brilliant Jennifer Chatman. Jennifer, it's really a privilege to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So before we begin, I just want to frame our conversation a little bit. You've done so much important research on how to leverage culture for organizational performance. And I just love this quote of yours that culture is your strategy execution engine. And I believe that we need to have a culture that is healthy, strong, and enables us to deliver on our strategy and have a positive impact on our various stakeholders. A part of this that we perhaps do not talk too much about is that we can be seemingly highly successful and still suffer from an unhealthy or even toxic culture that will ultimately influence the long-term impact and success of the organization. So before we zoom in on some of your research in this area, I would just like to ask you, how would you define a healthy culture in contrast to an unhealthy or perhaps a toxic culture?
Well, I think about three criteria for using culture as an organizational tool. The first one you already mentioned in the quote, which has to do with aligning the culture with your strategic priorities. And so the culture ought to help people engage most frequently in the behaviors that are most essential for delivering on your strategic promise. So if you're an R&D organization, you know, who is, or a pharmaceutical company who's interested in developing cutting edge medications for people, then, you know, research and taking some well-intentioned risks are going to be much more important than making sure that you don't spend too much money and cost efficiencies. So that strategic relevance piece is very important in enabling an organization's ability to deliver on its strategic promise. And then the second piece is that the culture needs to be strong, which means that not only do people agree with the priorities, but there's a kind of intensity behind it. People are willing to go out on a limb in order to uphold the culture in some way, that there's a real commitment to making it happen, because it's really easy to agree with all of the nice things that organizations are trying to do. But unless people have the behavioral conviction, even when it's difficult, even when you're challenged, even when nobody's looking, that's when you know you have a strong culture. And then finally, the culture needs to be adaptive over time. And, you know, that piece we found in a fairly recent research study to be quite pivotal. You could have a strategically relevant, strong culture, one that even emphasizes being results oriented. But unless you're also focused on adaptation and innovation over time, the organization can become inertial. That is, it can become inwardly focused and not adapt the culture to address challenges in the environment that might threaten it. So I just want to stop there and say, I still really haven't answered your question, because you asked the question about a toxic organization. So you could line up all three of those things and still, right, you could have a strategically relevant, strong, and adaptive organization. It could still be kind of evil and terrible, right? You could be pursuing negative ends. And in fact, some of our research has compared on a continuum strong culture organizations to religious cults, right? The mechanisms are exactly the same. It's just that the ends are more sinister than what most business organizations are trying to pursue. So from that perspective, right, you also need to have, you know, good values. And it, in my mind, it almost goes without saying. And that's less to me about the culture and more about the values of the organization, its mission, the recognition that collective effort is required to accomplish anything big, which means that there are going to be lots of people involved. And you must have some, you know, munificent view of the value of human effort and human contribution, and, you know, a kind of people orientation that is relevant to what organizations do. The notion of collaboration and pulling people together makes it essential that at least one of your core values should be focused on, you know, making the workplace a good place for people to push themselves and to feel fulfilled and to demonstrate excellence and to be trained and supported. And in my mind, that's not even a cultural issue. That's really an issue of fundamental values.
You've published some highly interesting research recently that has gained quite some attention on how a narcissistic leader influences culture. And we will dig deeper into that concept together. But first, I just wanted to ask you to give your definition of what narcissistic leadership really is.
Well, there are many, there's one very specific clinical definition of narcissism published by, the world of clinical psychology that's accepted around the world. It's in the what's called the DSM manual, and it has various components to it. But the signature features are people who are highly self-involved, feel a sense of entitlement, feel a sense of personal superiority over others. They're not on par with others. They actually believe themselves to be better than others and therefore entitled to more. A sense often of what we call grandiosity, which is big ideas and a kind of accompanying overconfidence about those ideas, which makes them a little bit immune to listening to the advice of others, and an orientation towards exploiting others and not treating other people well, treating people as a means to their own ends. Those are the signature characteristics of a narcissist.
You point out that there are a lot of characteristics that we might value in a leader that also shows up in a narcissistic leader. And what would you say to someone who thinks that leaders who challenge status quo and really build influential organizations have to be a bit of narcissists?
I would say they're absolutely wrong. I would say that that's a terrible mistake to make. And in fact, many of our most visionary leaders have not been narcissists. I talk about people like Bill Gates, there are any number of people who do not have narcissistic qualities who have absolutely had immense visions that have changed the world and had a huge positive impact. And I think what's happening when people blur together the idea of, narcissism is that they're failing to recognize that a person can have confidence without being overconfident. A person can have a big idea without the idea being grandiose. A person can, believe in themselves and believe in their ideas without being, ridiculous and exploitative of others and unwilling to learn anything new and accept the guidance and thoughts of others. And so it's not even really a continuum. It's a qualitative difference. So I just reject outright the idea. We do know that CEOs are disproportionately high on the trait of narcissism. And from my perspective, the reason is not that narcissists are performing better, the research shows that they're not, or not that they need to be narcissistic to be an effective leader, but the people who are selecting them are making this error. In the case of CEOs, it's boards of directors who are overlapping the attributes that are actually essential for significant leadership with the traits of narcissism. And distinguishing between those, I think, is vitally important. An organization's fate can hang in the balance of whether or not you get that right. And you separate, I think in my head, of almost Venn diagrams. And there are some attributes that could be overlapping, but they're not necessarily so. Again, I talked about confidence, but not overconfidence, big ideas, but not grandiose ideas, right? Willingness to direct and inspire others, but not exploitative, right? So these are qualitatively different attributes. And I believe that organizations at all levels need to build in practices that will enable them to differentiate effective leaders from those who will be narcissistic.
So how do you think, for example, that a board or a group of investors can do that? I mean, what would you advise them to do as they think about in their recruitment processes, for example, or looking at what type of founders we should be investing in and so on to avoid hiring or investing in narcissistic leaders?
Yeah, I think there are three key elements that anyone hiring any kind of leader wants to think very, very hard about. The first, and to me, this is almost the telltale sign, is to look at that person's, the candidate's track record with respect to developing other people. And what you would want to see is someone who has shared the spotlight, who's brought other people along with their own success. If you see in that track record, no one else that has risen to any significant level of power, that's a sign that the focal candidate is not really sharing success. And that's hugely problematic. Again, all a leader does really is inspire people and get them to collaborate to accomplish some shared objective. There is no big outcome, big goal that a leader could accomplish single-handedly. And so it is a requirement to have people along for the ride who can help you. And if you find that there's a person who hasn't really significantly developed, people at every level, that's a sign that they may be a narcissist, that they're overclaiming credit for success, that they're not investing in others, and that they're not sharing the spotlight. So that's one. A second one is, I think one of the things that happens is that we get lulled and seduced by the big ideas that narcissistic leaders have. And often those big ideals fail to recognize the obstacles, the constraints, you know, the parts of the idea that are not well researched yet. And I think boards of directors in particular, when you ask the question, you know, what would your first year at this organization look like, right? There needs to be a deep analysis of everything that candidate says. Is it realistic? Have they taken account of any of the obstacles? What are the assumptions that they're making? You know, how will this big idea play out? And I think that we're not careful enough to kind of do that kind of deep analysis and sort of pull apart these big ideas. And finally, it's important to check very, very carefully about history of exploitation and treating people badly. It sort of relates to the first piece, but is also kind of a separate activity that you want to engage in. And really looking for evidence that the focal leader has learned over time, has been able to take the advice of experts, has sought out and positioned experts in his or her, but mostly his, cabinet and network, that this is a person who is open to learning and able to, I would say, admit when he or she is wrong. Those to me are three very, very important areas that any hiring manager and certainly a board of directors would want to do significant due diligence on.
I'm thinking when you talk about number three, that also kind of connects with accountability and checks and balances, that if a leader is perhaps not willing to submit to structures of accountability or checks and balances, that's also a red flag. And that sometimes we think that a very entrepreneurial leader, they just have to have their space, but those structures are still very important.
Yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't thought about it quite that way, but you know, if you are seriously considering someone who you suspect may be a narcissist, right, putting those kinds of guardrails in place to structure the appointment and having milestones along the way where you're checking in on specific issues would be very, very important, both to gather the information, but also, as you're saying, you know, if you have someone who balks at that kind of structure, that is a signal that you could be in for trouble.
When you talked about number two, and you talk about kind of these maybe grandiose ideas where there's not really any maybe connection with reality, but because I mean, at the same time, I mean, we want the visionary and we want to see, I mean, the ideas that kind of will change the world or whatever kind of area that is in. But I directly thought about the story of Theranos and kind of, I don't know how familiar you are with it. I guess you are, but I talked a little bit with Max Baserman about that. And he talked about how the board, that he means that they had a moral obligation to notice really and ask questions that they didn't take. But even in a situation like that, why do you think that we are so kind of easily fooled by a situation like that, where it's kind of, I mean, when you look at the story afterwards, you kind of see that there was not a lot of connection maybe with reality, and that there were people that have had the medical expertise that have said that this is basically impossible to do. What would you say?
Yeah, well, Elizabeth Holmes, I think for sure fits the profile of a narcissist. And, you know, the good news is that it doesn't happen that much. The fact that that was a big story, and I would say Enron before that was a similar kind of case. These don't happen that often, and they still are very noteworthy, which is a good thing. It means that it's not business as usual. I'm actually on a board of directors, and so have that perspective. And yes, absolutely, boards need to be incredibly vigilant and ask questions. But if you think about the Theranos case, the early data was actually fairly fine-grained and it was looking good. It was later on when things sort of went south and Elizabeth Holmes actually started shutting down more and even presenting false data to the board and to others and faking tests and so forth. So there are a couple of dynamics I think that are very important. The first one is that boards don't have perfect information. That's absolutely true. Boards are reliant on management to provide information to them. And one of the, you know, the tensions in that relationship is you want to maintain a good relationship with management, the board does, in order to keep open communication. And the more the board challenges management, right, the more strained that relationship becomes. So it's essential to build in all kinds of norms that enable, you know, constructive confrontation and deep debate on issues and full transparency, and boards to sort of set expectations about, you know, what it is that it will want to look in on. So that's essential, and that requires a very delicate balance between boards and management. So that's one. You know, another issue is that if people are going to lie and, you know, cheat and withhold information, which narcissists do routinely, it's pretty hard to detect that. And the Theranos situation has even this greater intrigue to it, because she recruited to her board, you know, people like Henry Kissinger. I mean, you know, incredibly brilliant, lofty individuals. And I actually think, and maybe Max talked about this because his early research was in the area of escalation of commitment, but, you know, there was an escalation there where at some point it was starting to get embarrassing for the board to not have done more due diligence, given how acclaimed the group was. And I actually think that at some point the board was just like, oh my gosh, I mean, we kind of forgot to ask these things. We were so captivated by Elizabeth Holmes, you know, aura, you know, almost cult-like aura, you know, and her sort of conveyed image of being brilliant and incredible and, you know, unprecedented, that we forgot to put in place regular kinds of checks and balances. And now we're seeing things get strange. And it's super embarrassing that we didn't do that. So I think there was some element of the board being behind the curve and feeling a kind of regret for not having been more diligent and you know, thoughtful about how they were going to monitor this organization.
That's awesome. One thing that I think we see in a lot of organizations is that when we think about and work on culture, and we're going to talk about it soon in more about the narcissistic type of leadership, but that we relegate work or focus on culture to an HR function or to an ethics function or whatever that is. And we don't really see the responsibility of leadership. We don't really see that. I mean, in my view, that's the compliance and the HR function cannot actually build culture. Leaders do. And what would you say about the impact and the influence of leaders in an organization in regards to building culture?
Yeah, there's no substitute for top leadership taking ownership over the culture, in the sense of feeling a responsibility for cultivating an effective culture and demonstrating it themselves. It's impossible to say you want a culture which emphasizes, you know, inclusion and respect and, you know, sharing the spotlight, and then having a leadership team that is, you know, the opposite. And, you know, that happens in many organizations, and it breeds, I think it's worse than not saying anything at all, because you breed a kind of cynicism in the organization that is very, very problematic. The smartest organizations work in partnership with HR functions, or in some cases, risk functions, or in some cases, data science functions, to continually monitor the organization and have a very comprehensive approach to culture. I like to think about culture as, my last name is Chapman with a C, culture has a C. I like to think of the three C's of culture: consistency, coherence, and comprehensiveness, right? Consistency means that, you know, you do what you say. You know, there is some continuity of the culture over time as well. I guess that's the fourth C. Coherence, meaning that it makes sense to people, it's logical, it relates to what the organization is trying to do. And comprehensive means that the culture is enforced all around you. There is no sort of slippage and, you know, letting people slide, or particularly letting leaders slide and not be subject to the same set of norms and expectations that others in the organization are. And if you think about examples of organizations that really, you know, think about culture as the responsibility of senior leader teams, you know, Apple, Netflix, you know, Microsoft, Maersk in Europe, you know, these are organizations where senior leaders really think that the responsibility falls on them to ensure that the culture is aligned strategically, is strong as and is enforced, is updated over time, is understood and cascaded throughout the organization. These are critical responsibilities for organizations, so much so that one of the pioneering researchers in the domain of organizational culture, Ed Schein, said, it's really the only job of a senior leader is to leverage the culture of the organization. The CEO's job essentially is to ensure that people have a roadmap for making difficult decisions, judgment calls, trade-offs that are aligned with their strategy and make sense.
I find that many times CEOs and senior leaders, I mean, they know how they work with their strategy. That feels like tangible. It's something they do all the time. But when they think about culture, they feel that it's, hard to grasp. It's a bit mushy or whatever you'll say, and they don't really know. So what do I actually do? What is it that I should be thinking about? And what would you say? Of course, there's so much to say, but what do you say are some of the most important thing that senior leaders need to do to kind of take up their culture responsibility?
Well, this is something I've thought about a lot, and there are many ways to answer the question, but just because something appears less quantifiable, and I'm going to put an emphasis on less because it actually is quantifiable, you can't shy away from it. So let me start here, which is no matter what a leader does or doesn't do, a culture will form, right? It's inevitable. There's no way that when you bring people together on a regular basis where important things are at stake, like their job responsibilities and their status and their financial well-being, norms will form. So leaders don't have a choice about whether or not a culture is going to form. It will. The only choice they have is what form those norms take. And my sort of career has been spent trying to convince leaders that punting on that is really not an option. That is, allowing norms to form organically runs the risk that the norms that form not only could not be supportive of what you're trying to accomplish, but they could be counter to the objectives the organization is trying to pursue. And so I just think it's not an option to avoid or ignore culture or say, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. It's just not an option. Okay, so then what do we do? We know a lot now. There's a lot to be done. The first is to use those three criteria I started our conversation with as actual criteria. Is our culture strategically relevant, right? Is our culture strong? Is it adaptive over time? And I've developed a tool with Charles O'Reilly at Stanford University and Dave Caldwell, who's formerly at the University of Santa Clara, where we measure those three things, right? You can measure the extent to which the current culture is aligned with the ideal culture if you were fully executing on your strategy. You can statistically measure the extent to which people agree about how the norms are arrayed and prioritized throughout their organization. And you can measure the extent to which the organization focuses on adaptability. And we have dozens of papers that report in academic journals that require, you know, very, very intensive statistical analyses and blind review that these criteria matter. They matter on the bottom line for financial performance. One of our more recent studies showed, in fact, that if you get the culture right, we looked at 60 of the largest publicly traded high technology firms across a 6-year period, and we found that getting the culture right mattered. Let me make sure I get the numbers right. These firms together control about $1 trillion in the U.S. GDP. They have about $32 billion of average annual revenue. And getting the culture right was worth about 15% of that annual revenue, or about $5 billion a year. So, right, even when we look at this scientifically, culture matters, and there's a lot that you can do. So we have these three criteria, and if you found, for example, that your organization was not living up to those three criteria, there are a set of levers that you would want to look at to, you know, bring together where your current culture is and where your ideal culture should be. Those levers include who you hire, right? Hire people who resonate with the organization, that the culture that you're trying to create. If you're an organization that needs to be more innovative, you probably need to search for people who have a greater risk tolerance, right, than exists in the current organization. Once people join the organization, ensure that they hit the ground running. Help them understand the culture that you're trying to cultivate in very transparent terms, right? Training people, helping create a vivid understanding of what success looks like, curating stories of success within the organization that people can learn from. Third is the reward system. And here's where both formal and informal rewards need to align to prioritize the things that are actually important. And frankly, we found that there's often less flexibility with formal rewards, and that formal rewards like compensation systems, which despite what economists want to believe, are pretty blunt tools for motivating behavior. But in fact, there are all kinds of informal rewards, celebrations, naming people who have done a great job and thanking them publicly. Very sort of small but regular articulations of what is valued in the organization are absolutely essential. And then the final one, which is sort of where we started, is that leaders need to demonstrate these behaviors absolutely, and without defaulting in significant ways. They are the people to whom others are looking for guidance and direction. And if leaders are not adhering to the very norms that are important, then nobody else is going to bother either.
That's so good. And thank you so much for that. I think very much about the word integrity, and I think it is so central that if we do not have that integrity, no values will have any value. And what we have to build into our system, build into our reward systems and everything. And I wanted to take the conversation a little bit back to the narcissistic leadership. And just as we've been talking about the influence that leaders have, you have also seen that a narcissistic leadership can really influence and shape the culture. And in what ways have you found that it does?
Well, yes, this is very disturbing. We have a paper in press right now, again, with Charles O'Reilly at Stanford, where we find across five different studies with close to 2,000 participants and both lab experiments and field studies, we find that there's a robust connection between narcissistic leaders and a lower emphasis on collaboration and integrity, exactly what you were talking about as being so vitally important. And again, the reason that that's so important is that collaboration and integrity are, in my mind, the lifeblood of organizations. Right. Again, I've said a couple of times, the reason you organize, if you ask the question, why organize? Why have an organization? The answer is because we can do something together that no one of us could do alone. And so collaboration is the essence of coming together as an organization, and a leader who undermines that collaboration will break apart that very essence. So this is important. And what we see is that narcissistic leaders tend to stoke infighting and internal competition, and people would rather try to get themselves in a favorable light with the boss than cooperate with one another. And because narcissists like people to have allegiance to them rather than strong bonds among one another, you know, that's how this problem arises. So that's terribly, terribly problematic. And then with regard to integrity, because narcissistic leaders have this sense of entitlement and personal superiority, they believe that the rules don't apply to them and that the rules don't apply to their organizations. And you know, Donald Trump, the world's most famous narcissist, before he became president, he ran his real estate company. Just as a side note, his real estate company was involved in 5 times more lawsuits than the rest of the industry combined, which shows that whether he's on the plaintiff or the defendant side, it doesn't matter. He was either defending against being accused of doing something wrong, or he was pushing a lawsuit because he believed he and his company shouldn't have been subject to those rules. So this kind of integrity, which has been shown to relate to, you know, cheating, lying, and stealing, the accounting and finance academic world is seeing this as well, that overconfident leaders, narcissistic leaders, are much more likely to be accused of fraud, to experience SEC challenges, and so forth. And so this is an enormous problem for organizations. If you can't maintain your integrity, I mean, even just from a sheer legal standpoint, the very survival of the organization is at stake. Now, this will probably be your next question, so let me try to anticipate it, which is, I think the most disturbing part of our findings were not just that narcissistic leaders tend to cultivate cultures that are lower in collaboration and integrity, but that those cultures remained intact after narcissistic leaders left. There was a kind of residue of the leader, and it took a long time for organizations to kind of dig out from this. And, you know, frankly, here in the US, where we've just been through a major election, you know, the world is aware of that. I mean, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are going to have quite a job to dig out from some of the things that the narcissistic president has put in place over these last 4 years. And, you know, and that's very problematic, that the culture outlives the actual leader. So it's very, very important that organizations get this right and use all of the tools and insights that they can to ensure that the leaders they're bringing in are not tipping the scale on narcissism, because our research shows that it won't end well.
So if you have a situation, I've worked with some organizations that have kind of come out of a scandal where you've had a leader that, and of course, in so many of these cases, and I cannot say necessarily that the leader has been a narcissist, maybe in some cases that's been a part of it, but where there's been, I mean, of course, they have started something and people have a like strong relationship to them. At the same time, there has been some behavior that has led to an unhealthy culture, and it's led to kind of a system where they have allowed themselves to do things that, yeah, they shouldn't have, and so on. And I'm just thinking, how do you kind of heal the organization? How do you heal the culture after that? How do you deal with it? And how do you heal the culture?
Well, the first step is recognizing that there will be this kind of residue or hangover effect, and that just by switching out the leader, your problems are not going to go away. And we do. We've long had... in sociology, there's a theory of scapegoating that organizations often try to load up all their problems into the embodiment of a single leader, and then assume that once that leader leaves, you know, we're all done and there's no problem. So the first step is really recognizing that that's not how it works, and a new leader would need to plan for a long range, dedicated, significant effort to undo the damage. And I think what people would probably say is that the first order of business is, you know, sort of trust and a recognition that the new leader is going to build in integrity and value collaboration and show quick and significant and long-lasting evidence that those are valued qualities in the organization. And I would say, you know, you would make the case strategically that it's good for the organization. You would then go to your levers and use the same four levers to ensure that this happens, right? Probably, you know, remove people who were highly active in the last regime and bring in people who are more oriented toward the values and culture that you're trying to cultivate. You know, changing reward systems, particularly informal rewards, changing behavior as a leader. And I would say that, you know, if you look at the new CEO at McDonald's who came in under difficult circumstances, I had an occasion to hear him speaking about his experience. And, you know, I think this is how he's spending much of his time right now. So the recognition that that it will be a long road, there will need to be a serious investment. He called himself a battleground appointment. and I think that that's right. You're coming into an organization that is not in good shape at the moment, and there's going to need to be a significant effort to change.
That's so great. And we're really finishing off this conversation. I just wanted to ask, when we think about culture and when we think about assessing our culture, I think like three kind of overarching questions, and I think we touched on them, but like it is kind of what in our culture will enable us to deliver on our strategy and to be the kind of organization that we want to be, to have a positive impact on our stakeholders, and what are the things that might hinder us, and then I would say a third question is, what are the things that could derail us, that could basically get us off track? And just as if you would speak to leaders and to HR compliance professionals and so on, what would you say about the need to continually assess the culture, and maybe some tip of what is good to be thinking about to make sure that we are kind of on track with all those three aspects?
Yeah, those are three really good ones. I would just augment it with one more, which is, what do we want to be known for? In fact, the internal culture is the inside part of your external brand, and those two should be aligned. If you get the culture right, your external brand should benefit from that. You should be attracting the people that actually are resonate with the culture that you're trying to cultivate. You should have relationships with customers and regulators, you know, who know you to be what it is you're aspiring to be. So that's vital as well. I am very, very supportive of ongoing assessment of an organization's culture. We have all kinds of methods for doing that, you know, so I'm happy to lay those out. But what I would say in a kind of more informal basis is, often HR executives believe that attitude surveys are the same as culture assessments, and they're not. Attitude surveys really ask individuals how they're feeling and what they think is important. A culture assessment asks, what are the norms around here? So it really asks the question, what do people here generally do and say? And so that distinction, if you can add some questions to, if you do an annual attitude survey, if you can add some questions that really get not at what each individual thinks, but what the aggregate thinks. What are the norms in this organization? What are the patterns of behavior that we expect and that we share? And that's when you're starting to assess the culture. And that can be actually very different from what an individual's attitudes are.
If you would just give like one or two or more examples of questions that you think are especially kind of helpful in getting to exactly that aspect of culture and not just of attitude.
Yeah. So people around here believe that innovation is important. You know, as an organization, we invest heavily in research and development. Right? Those kinds of questions. But you can also ask people things like, what is the story of success in this organization? And see what kinds of things bubble to the top. If stories of success are based in competition and disagreement, right? That's something that you would want to pay attention to. If stories of success are based on collaboration and high integrity, that's something else entirely.
Jennifer, thank you so much. I know that these are busy times for you, and I just really want to say that I'm so grateful that you wanted to take the time and to have this conversation. And I know that our listeners are very grateful too. And just wanted to ask you, are there any ways that our listeners could connect with you or learn more about your work and what you do?
Well, thank you. It's been a lovely conversation. As you can tell, this is a subject I like to talk about. Sure. If anyone would like to learn more about the way that I approach culture and how I measure it, I actually do consult with a number of organizations and have for many years. They're welcome to reach me at chatman@berkeley.edu. So Chatman, like talk a lot, Chatman. At Berkeley, BERKELEY.EDU. That's the university where I am a professor, and I would be delighted to hear from any of you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.